Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm so happy to have Maya Binyam here in the studio. Maya, thanks for coming here 20 minutes after you arrived from the airport.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy it's my first stop.
I feel like we should give the Comet a shout out for we made a stop there on the way here.
Yeah, thank you, Comet, for caffeinating me.
This show isn't brought to you by the Comet, but anyway, but they're good neighbors. Yeah. They're really good neighbors. Maya, you're here in town for the Zelle Visiting Writer Series. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow, you're going to be at UMA to give a reading. Mm-hmm. And will you be reading from Hangman, the novel on the table?
I'm not going to be reading from Hangman. I'm going to read from the novel that I'm working on now. So it'll be new stuff.
Oh, and yeah. Can we talk about the novel a little bit later, too?
Yeah, definitely. We'll see if I can describe it.
Okay. Yeah. Stay tuned. Yeah. And then on Friday, you'll be giving a craft lecture. Mm-hmm. Do you have an idea of?
Yeah, it's going to be about secrets and the sort of possibilities for structuring plot and character around secrets, conscious and unconscious secrets.
Oh, okay.
We'll see how it goes.
I love that. Especially when you said unconscious, it felt like it just raised those stakes up.
Well, yeah, we keep many secrets that we don't know we keep, I think.
I think so, yeah, too. Yeah. Not that I've been thinking about it,
yeah.
But now I will. Yeah, thank you, Maya. Yeah. And thanks for choosing the songs for today's mm-hmm. program. What was it that we first heard?
The first song was a song from this album called... Musique de Nuit. I'm not a speaker of French, so I probably mispronounced that. But it is an album that's a collaboration between Balaké Sissoko and I'm trying to remember the name of the other guy. He's a cellist. He's a French cellist. And it's a really beautiful album. I actually only just started listening to it. I've been living in a rural area, and so my listening habits have kind of shifted accordingly. I normally listen to very upbeat, fast-paced music, and now I've been listening to a lot of slower stuff and jazz, and I found this album just very beautiful and calming.
How did you find it too, Maya?
How did I find it? I mean, I listen to a lot of Ethiopian jazz, and probably there will be some other Ethiopian jazz that's played during the program, and music from Mali, and so I'm always sort of looking for new music from West Africa, and then also Ethiopian artists.
Oh, I'm so glad. Thanks for bringing this one.
Yeah, sure. It's great. It's a good way to start.
And when you say rural area, mm-hmm. that's Bard College neighborhood.
Yes, rural, and also a campus. So yeah.
Because you're currently there for a residency.
Yeah, I'm there in residence this semester, which has been really, really nice so far.
Is it a whole year?
No, it's just one semester. And then I'm doing another residency next semester. So it's a year of residencies for me.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's great.
Where to next?
Next, I'm going to Rome, which will be fun. I think. I hope it'll be fun.
Yes, yeah. We're all going with you, Maya.
Yes. Yeah. Surprise.
Surprise. We're here. We're going. That sounds so wonderful. Yeah. Well, can't wait to hear about that at a future time. Yeah. And no shadow over you, Bard. You're also wonderful.
Yeah.
Anyone?
Bard's amazing.
Bard Land is listening. And so the music, do you think it's also, because you're writing a lot there for the residency, I'm working on the new novel.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the music, is it playing a part in the writing, or is it sort of even when you're like, you're not listening to music when you write? Or?
It's a good question. I definitely don't listen to music when I write. I need a lot of silence. I wish I was someone who could listen to music while I write, because I know for many writers the sort of rhythm and movements of music can really help them figure out the rhythm and movements of their language. I find it very distracting, and I've gone through periods when I'm writing a lot where I sort of intentionally don't listen to any music. So I've gone like a month or two at a time not listening to anything.
Because it is so influential in a way.
It's really influential, but I also think I can get kind of neurotic about working in isolation and just sort of disavowing things and excising things. And I don't know that it's actually a helpful tactic. Like, I would never suggest to someone else that if they wanted to get writing done, they should like excise music from their life. Like, I don't necessarily think it's good, but that has been my impulse historically. I want to enjoy my life now. So I am listening to music, but not while I write.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Did you always write when you were a kid, or when did you start writing? And
yeah, I mean, I did always write. I think all of my early experiences of writing were in school. I remember really struggling with diaristic writing. I always wanted to have a diary and I always struggled to keep one. So most of the writing that I was doing was not in my own time. Like it was to satisfy the requirements of whatever class I was in when I was quite young.
And would you have these journals and diaries, and maybe they'd have a page or so?
Yeah,
or you'd look at them,
I have so many childhood journals that start like, "Today is my birthday. I just got this diary as a gift. I vow to write in it every single day and record all of my thoughts and feelings and everything that happens to me." And then the rest of it is blank. I have a bunch of those, but I've since actually developed like a really rigorous journaling practice or diary keeping practice. So I feel like my childhood ambitions have been finally realized, which
yes.
is awesome.
In its own time.
Yeah, in its own time. It took me, like 30 years, but
why did you start? Why did you
most recently
bring this practice in? Yeah.
I am very anxious about forgetting things. I have a very good memory, but I think because I have a good memory, I'm also really attuned to the things that sort of slip away through the passage of time. And I found that as I was entering adulthood in earnest, sort of like exiting my second adolescence, suddenly childhood felt very, very, very far away, and in a way that I had never experienced, obviously, because, you know, when I was 25, 10 years before that, I was 15. Like, it just didn't feel so long ago. Childhood felt much more present.
Yeah.
And now
it's the accordion is.
Yeah.
Close.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And so I think I've become more conscious of the fact that the moments I'm living through now will become vague in the same way. And so I feel sort of like competing impulses between recording things so that I might have a way to access them later. But also I've found it really pleasurable to have these ongoing narratives that run kind of like parallel to life. You know, they like have something to do with the events that are happening every day, but they're not the same as like what's actually happening every day. Like, when you write a diary, you're telling a very particular story, and you're not you're like choosing in the moment what you think is going to be valuable to you in the future. And in the process of that, you actually lose a lot. Like, I don't think it rectifies the natural processes of like forgetting something, but you do start telling a particular kind of story. And I think I've just become interested in that kind of like, yeah, that kind of storytelling that runs parallel to life.
And is it something now that it feels like it would be hard not to write each day in the diary or in the journal?
Yeah. I mean, I'm spending a lot of time alone right now. And I think because of that, my diary, I mean, it sounds like I'm so isolated. I'm like, my diary's my companion. But I do, you know, I eat a lot of meals alone right now because I'm living upstate by myself. And oftentimes, you know, while I'm eating, I'm writing, as opposed to, you know, normally I would prioritize having a meal with someone else. And I really like that part of my regular life. Yeah, I forget where your question was, but...
What was it? Let's see. Well, writing, like, do you feel like you would need to write? And I think you were saying,
yeah.
Well, I do anyway
yeah.
right now.
Yeah, I do right now. And I can imagine it shifting, though, like when my life, I mean, we were talking earlier before the show started that about how I'm a Gemini. And so I operate between extremes and like extreme periods of socializing and extreme periods of isolation. And I'm in an isolated period. And I can imagine, you know, re-entering my sort of like frenetic social life and ceasing to keep a diary. But it's something I would like to keep up. I keep a very consistent dream diary no matter like if I'm socializing or not socializing.
How so? How do you do that? Is it to actually, because you work in surrealist ideas
yeah.
and mindscapes that yeah. become narratives.
Yeah.
It seems like to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm just really invested in having a dream life, and I don't derive so much like meaning from my dreams, and I don't often go back and read my dream diary, but I found that recording my dreams makes me have more interesting dreams and helps me remember them. And I just really like going to sleep and experiencing something interesting.
Do you wake up in the night and write things down, or only in the morning?
Only in the morning. It's rare that I wake up in the middle of the night generally. So yeah, only in the morning. It's the first thing I do when I get up.
It's because you're so young. No, I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. I'm like feeling older and older these days.
Yeah, yeah. We all are. It's happening to all of us.
Coming down the line.
Yeah.
But it also seems like it's interesting with your craft lecture.
Mm-hmm.
You're thinking about secrets, mm-hmm. conscious and unconscious, and the dreams being a path into the unconscious
yeah.
mind. Maybe.
Yeah, I'm gonna mention this on Friday, but and it's possible that I'm gonna butcher it now. But I think Freud believed that dreams were manifestations of things that the unconscious wanted to keep hidden, and Jung. Believe that dreams were signs of secrets that the unconscious, you know, was attempting to reveal. So I do think dreams and secrets are they're very closely tied.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting because like to reveal the secrets or
yeah.
to solve or to kind of work out
yeah.
some sort of resolution.
Yeah.
Or...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I do feel like in a dream state, the unconscious is often sort of like roving through material that it can be hard to recognize during waking life.
So do you read Freud and Jung, or is it something that you studied when in undergrad at Yale?
No,
or?
I mean, I did read... The Interpretation of Dreams by Freud in a lit theory class. So I read some Freud, and Jung I've only gotten into probably in the past month and a half, 2 months. Like
in the rural
yes,
area.
Yes, exactly. Jung has been my companion. I mean, I also live in LA where a lot of people are Jungians. I do think there's a kind of geographic... I feel like a lot of people in New York, where I used to live, are Freudians, and a lot of people in LA are into Jung. So I'm also just, following in the footsteps of those who traveled west before me.
journeys.
Yes, there
are many journeys.
Yeah, but I'm by no means an expert. Like, I'm a total novice. But I find the language of psychoanalysis very helpful for writing, and more helpful for me, at least, than the sort of typical language of craft.
Let's come back to that,
because
that's something to talk about.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a quick break now.
Yeah.
And then we'll be back. Today on Living Writers, Maya Binyam is here, Hangman, the novel on the table with us, out with Picador. But we're going to hear about what Maya's working on, too. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Maya Binyam is here. Hangman, the novel on the table with us. Maya, what was the song we just got to hear part of?
That was Hasta Wasalo by a band called Admas. It was originally a song that was performed with... It was performed in Ethiopia with... this band that I want to say it was like the Emperor's band or like a military band, but this band Admas, which was assembled in DC and was like comprised of these musicians who had left Ethiopia. This is their rendition of that song, and I think it's really beautiful.
It's beautiful,
yeah, and haunting.
It is.
Well, but it's a love
even
song.
From the beginning,
yeah.
It sounds so, you know, just like the entrance into it.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of pulling you along like soft waves or mm-hmm. so on the shore. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
That's a good description.
I read one of your essays, and I'm actually not remembering which piece it was, Maya, but in it, you talk about your name,
That piece.
You know, and I love how, as you're writing about it, you're like skewering writing about names. You're all the boring, you know, things that people were. And yours was absolutely not boring, but there's like that moment where you, as a child, you're with your dad and maybe uncle at a coffee shop, and you stand on the table and you yell out, "I am Ethiopian."
Yeah.
When you were just a wee lass.
Yeah. That was a story that my dad really loved to tell when I was a kid. And I don't have a memory of it, but yeah, he always told this story about, bringing me to this coffee shop in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he lived, and bringing me with, my uncle, his brother, who he also lived with, and you know, my mom is white, and I'm much lighter skin than my father, and he described sort of like people looking from me to him and from him to me, and feeling like something suspicious was going on, you know, like these two middle-aged African men with this child
and just
of
trying
like,
to have
unknown
a
racial origin. Oh, yeah. You know, like and this was in Boston, so which is, you know, a very, very racist city and very segregated city. So anyway, he told this story about sort of me going around to everyone and trying to say hi, and everyone just sort of like not really meeting my greetings with any kind of enthusiasm, meeting them in fact with suspicion. And I guess I noticed that and in some way detected what it was about, and yeah, got up on the table and screamed, "I am from Ethiopia." But it's funny like hearing these stories about yourself as a kid that you don't remember, where you're like, did this actually happen? Or, you know, is my parent telling a redemption story that they sort of like, I mean, I believe my dad, but I also can see why his young child taking that action would feel redeeming, and so it's a story that
it's a hero story.
Yeah, it's a hero story.
And showing how like even as a young child,
yeah,
you had a sense of self identity,
yeah,
and not to be. Like, I don't know, like to, yeah. you could understand something that,
yeah,
was happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would like to believe it's true. It's just funny that, that I don't have a memory of it, that my sense of it is only, of that experience is only, has only been gleaned by that story that my dad told me, which I think for both of us serves a purpose.
And it's a touchstone or so. Mm-hmm. In the acknowledgments, Maya, mm-hmm, you mentioned like one of the last people you thank is your dad, mm-hmm, and his first name is your last name.
Mm-hmm.
And you say they thank him for the telling, like teaching you how, like telling stories and teaching, yeah, you how.
Yeah. 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 My dad told a lot of stories when I was growing up, and he crucially also didn't tell stories. Like how do I even describe this? But my father grew up under conditions that were very different from the conditions under which I grew up. He grew up in rural Ethiopia. His parents died when he was quite young, and so he and his brothers sort of raised each other in this very small town. And they were resourced. They had land, but you know, they didn't have electricity, they didn't have plumbing, they didn't have parents. And my father at a young age became a political organizer. And was, I mean, this is the really the Spark Notes version, but was.
Thank you.
Yeah.
For telling.
Yeah. That. Yeah, sure. But just after or during the revolution that began in 1974, he was arrested and became a political prisoner and was in prison for a few years. And when he was released, fled the country. And that sort of extraordinarily brief syncopated version of what he experienced in those years, even those slim details, were details that I gleaned over my entire lifetime. He told lots of stories, but there are many things that he experienced that I understand cannot be calcified in language. And I think a yearning to understand something that for me is fundamentally impossible to understand, or impossible at least to put into words. I think that sort of is what inspired my desire to write, the sort of like the tension between understanding that there are so many stories that I haven't been told, that I can only sort of glean through I don't know, like sensorily or through the sort of like unspoken stuff that binds people. That's sounding very vague, but hopefully makes some sense.
It does. Yeah. It does make sense. Yeah. I wonder with, the novel Hangman that we, mm-hmm, have on the table, it's fiction, mm-hmm, and but the main character is a male character who's mm-hmm. about maybe 55 mm-hmm. or so. But it is interesting that this male character has died three times in their body, in their life, mm-hmm. like once as a boy mm-hmm. was buried mm-hmm. and then once when they were a political prisoner,
yeah.
but managed to survive yeah. when many died,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And then went to the U.S.
Yeah.
Are these, and then there's more to yeah. come in the story mm-hmm. but were these conscious moments for you mm. of paralleling your dad's story mm. in some way or no,
yeah.
or was it just something like these are stories you understand so it can become part of the like grist for the mill or
yeah.
so.
That's such a smart reading. And I've never thought about the book in that way, that there are these kind of, sequential deaths and rebirths, but that is such a smart reading. And that's honestly kind of, it changes the book in many ways for me. So I'm just trying to sort of like integrate that into my sense of it right now. But, yeah, I think I was very curious about how those sort of, how these moments of political rupture and then life in the wake of political rupture, how they, shape consciousness and could shape the story that someone tells about, in this case, himself. And yeah, those parallels between the narrator's life and my father's life were definitely things that I was actively thinking about. And the things that they share, you know, they don't share everything by any means. And the narrator's style of narration is very different from my father's style of narration. I think his sort of the things that animate him are different and his interests are different. But in terms of the biographical details, yeah, the narrator, like my father, was a political prisoner and has sought refuge in the U.S. And yeah, those loose biographical details were things that I knew I wanted to work with from the very beginning. And they wound up being sort of important anchors for the character. But I found that actually like so much more was conveyed to me, at least, through his voice, than through those biographical details. So that was interesting.
How yeah. did you find the narrator's voice?
Mm. It is really hard to trace, but
because it sounds like the voice was with you for a while, was mm-hmm. taking shape. And then I'm not sure the story of Hangman, the process of making it, but
yeah, the voice had been with me for a while. I started playing with probably like the earliest iteration of the voice when I was in college. I was 22 or something. And I realized that I said that the narrator's voice is very, or his style of narration is quite different from my father's style of narration. But I do think the origins of the voice, I'm going to sound contradictory here, because I had found when I was in college this travel diary that my father had kept on a visit to see his brother.
What a find.
Yes, I know. It was a find, and I wasn't really sure. I mean,
Things he wouldn't have told you, apparently,
yes,
right?
Yes, like, yes.
Because he was reticent about that.
Yes, and it was placed in my... I remember I went home on some break or something, and the diary was in my bedroom. I think it was on my bed. And so I wasn't sure if he wanted me to find it or not. In any case, I did not respect the privacy that typically is associated with a diary, and I read it.
It was in your bedroom.
It was in my bedroom in the house that he owns, but whatever. Yeah, so I read that, and I was really moved by that diary and moved by the fact that my father, who's not a writer, was and who doesn't typically keep a diary, was, for the purposes of this visit, consciously trying to sort of like fulfill the narrative expectations of what a travel diary is. And that was just very fascinating to me. And without going into details, that trip wound up being very difficult for him. And the difficulties of the trip were revealed in the details that he was assembling as he was sort of like consciously constructing this narrative of a vacation. And there was a tension between what actually happened and the sort of like expectations for what might happen when one goes on vacation to visit their brother. So I think that tension was something I was really interested in. And I started just by kind of like mimicking that diary. And I wrote a story that followed more closely the movements of that diary. And then I started writing in that voice, but about a fictional character, and about various periods in his life. And through the process of doing that, the voice inevitably changed. And, you know, I kept writing in that voice, just like for myself for some years. So it inevitably changed. And yeah.
Let's take a short break and then we'll come back. Today on the program, Maya Binyam is here, Hangman, the book on the table with us. I'm T. Hetzel, you've got Living Writers, and we'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today in the program, Maya Binyam is here. Maya, what were we just hearing?
Yeah, that was a song by Tsege Mariam Gebru, who was a nun and a church pianist. And she died pretty recently. I think it was last year, the year before. But most of her songs, she doesn't sing on them. But this is one where she does. And it's called, I think, Ethiopia, My Motherland. And she left Ethiopia when she was quite young. And she went to Jerusalem, I think, where she studied. She studied piano, and she was also maybe in a monastery there. Anyway, this is one of the songs where she sings, and she's singing in Amharic, but most of the song is indecipherable. Like she's saying, the one thing that is decipherable to my ear, at least, is Ethiopia Yene Agar, which means like Ethiopia, my country. But the rest of it is really hard to make out. And I've listened to this with people who speak Amharic much better than me, and they likewise can't make it out. And the song, because of that, to me, is filled with so much longing.
And so much mystery, too,
and
or
so
secrets.
Much mystery, yes, yes, yes.
Because definitely, yeah, there's so much, at least to me, I have a feeling from it. I can feel, even if I don't understand what she's telling me, but it does feel longing.
Yeah, you can feel the sense of longing. And what's interesting to me is like Ethiopia and the song is being invested with so much, and I don't know what it is because I can't make out the words, but I can tell that that there's like a huge amount of like psychic investment there. So I find it to be a very sad song, but one that I relate to.
Because of a longing for...
Yeah, I mean, I think this is typical of people who have forcibly or just in a way that was surprising to them, left behind their home countries in pursuit of life elsewhere, and whose lives have been reshaped in really unexpected ways by the places where they've sought refuge. And I'm sort of one generation out from that experience, and I feel very tethered to a place that I'll never really have access to. I mean, I go to Ethiopia. I've lived there before, and yet I feel that there's a sort of there's a degree of separation or some kind of sheen of unreality that exists between my life here and my life, how I conceive of it in my head, and this sort of like alternate, this alternate version of what my life could have been or what my father's life could have been had he not been forced to leave. So yeah, I feel like that sense of longing is what has bound my family in the States.
And do you have a lot of family in the States?
Yeah, I do.
Because I know you mentioned you have a lot of family back home in Ethiopia.
Yes, yeah, I still have a lot of family in Ethiopia, but I have a lot of cousins who have come here. So yeah, there are a number of us here now. Yeah.
Well, thanks for bringing that song.
Yeah, sure.
To us, this is it is beautiful. Mm. And it's especially since you said it's one of the few where she chooses to sing.
Yeah.
And so that's why it makes it even more beautifully strange that it's hard to make out what she's saying because she's choosing to sing it. But I guess the voice is an instrument, right?
Yeah.
So maybe for her, the sound of it was enough.
Yeah. I love the strain of the voice also. It feels very, it feels necessary to the song somehow.
It does. It feels almost old fashioned though, too.
Yeah.
Nice that we're tune in for more song analysis. But you know what, which reminds me, we were going to talk about psychoanalysis a while ago and how you find that might be more helpful in thinking about writing than some of like the like craft of writing
books, the craft language. I'll talk about this a little bit more on Friday too, but I've noticed that I sometimes my brain kind of like shuts off when confronted with the language of craft. And I recognize that as a kind of defense mechanism. I think craft has been a language that I've been very resistant to learning. And I don't know exactly why that is, because I've also found it quite compelling. Like, I think that they're brilliant thinkers on craft. And I have, in moments of stagnation in my writing process, sometimes found them incredibly helpful. And when I'm teaching, I've found them incredibly helpful. But when it comes to my own writing, I find the process of writing, and I think this is probably true for everyone who writes, like, I find the process of writing to be really, really mysterious. And I'm very protective of that sense of mystery. Like, I don't even want to understand. And it's not like I'm trying to shunt other people out of that. Like, I'm kind of trying to protect the sort of like my own unconscious impulses from my conscious mind. Like, I don't really want to understand them. Obviously, at a certain point, you do need to become conscious of your unconscious impulses, because if you're writing a text, you eventually need to edit it. And if you hope to have readers, you need to sort of understand how the text is operating. But I find it sort of helpful to, try to separate my sort of like my analytic language from the unconscious process of writing, which is about language, but or produces language, but is fundamentally kind of like mysterious and impossible to put into words.
So especially when you're like in an idea and you're drafting it, mm-hmm. and maybe like the first full draft, mm-hmm. it's not important to have that other lens on until.
Yeah. I mean, it's something I'm constantly battling because, I mean, the way that I'm talking about it, it makes it sound as if writing is a process that borders on like holy or something like that. And usually it doesn't feel that way. Like usually I'm wearing stained clothes and struggling to caffeinate
sweating
myself.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, like it doesn't like feel like I'm dwelling in the mysteries of the unconscious or whatever. Normally I feel much more tethered to the material world and my sort of like anxieties and neuroses. But the ideal is sort of just those glimmers when that stuff feels like it's been kind of stripped away or is not so relevant.
That makes complete sense.
Yeah.
And maybe you invent like for your own self, it's your own craft language. What you don't even want to say that because then I think you'd start resisting that maybe.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. It's true. But yeah, I mean I think I enjoy the process of thinking through. I mean, one of the many wonderful things about publishing a book is that you get to sort of like interpret your work alongside readers. And I've found that to be extraordinary and so pleasurable and very helpful, like personally helpful. So I enjoy doing that, but the writing, I think the I wasn't able to do that, for example, with Hangman until, you know, I'd been done writing it for a year or something. Mm. Yeah.
You mean to revise it even?
Oh no, I mean revising it. I could revise it. I think I couldn't really apply analytic language to it until basically it like felt dead to me. And then it got resurrected. You know, it got resurrected or whatever when people were reading it and I was talking with them about it. But
yeah. That is really interesting. Mm. I think, would you mind reading some of it? Because I feel like we keep talking about it.
So we'll, this we'll abstract let object. Let I'll read just the first two pages.
That sounds great.
Okay, so probably what the book is about will remain a mystery, but hopefully anyone who's listening will at least get a sense for the voice.
But that's kind of perfect then.
Yeah.
Mystery.
Okay, cool. So this is just from the very beginning. In the morning, I received a phone call and was told to board a flight. The arrangements had been made on my behalf. I packed no clothes because my clothes had been packed for me. A car arrived to pick me up. The radio announced traffic due to an accident involving a taxicab driver, a police officer, and a woman whose occupation the dispatcher did not specify. But there was no traffic. My ticket was in the breast pocket of my jacket, which was handed to me as I exited the passenger door. Waiting in line, I felt I had no body, but by the time I reached security, I was hungry. Inside my carry-on, I found two apples and a croissant, which tasted like nothing. The security agent asked me for my name. I gave him my driver's license, walked through the metal detector, and then my body went away. Before takeoff, a flight attendant announced our destination. Everyone cheered. The passenger to my right asked if I was happy to be going home. He didn't speak our destination's national language, which had become the language of the plane. I told him I was neither happy nor unhappy. He said he understood where I was coming from because his work had introduced him to people like me. He said that people like me had changed his life. It was true that they needed money, but the fact that he gave it to them had nothing to do with what they meant to him. His real life, outside our destination, was complicated by ambivalence. Since childhood, his basic needs had been met as if by an invisible force. At first, he believed his mother and father were providing for him, but when they died, he was surprised to feel he had suffered no loss. Care, he realized, didn't originate within his parents, whose protection remained palpable in almost everyone he encountered. Waitstaff, his internist, even the prime minister. It had merely taken up residence in their bodies, which he didn't need to visit, because the cemetery had nothing to do with the rest of his life. He looked cautious when he mentioned that word, cemetery, as if he had accidentally said a slur. When he was done worrying about being offensive, he moved on to talking about his wife. Things had come to her easily. As soon as they got married, she wanted children, and then she gave birth to two. She considered recipes to be extraneous. Instead, she ordered cooking magazines and then reproduced the food on the cover page from sight. He had no use for leftovers because his office provided a catered lunch. Everyone he worked with had been elevated to the status of a boss. They made a lot of money but weren't fond of discussing it, especially not with people like me. He appreciated the fact that people like me didn't have desires. His desires felt paralyzing because they weren't motivated by need. Everything was available to be possessed, which made it impossible to quantify an object or person's relative allure. He wished he had felt more lust for his mistress. I tried to relate to him and understand his concerns. I think I'll stop there.
Thanks, Maya. Yeah, thanks. Please. So this is the voice.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also the other voice, like there's the man.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we get to hear his voice, but then I guess it's all through his perspective that we're hearing it, like how he's perceiving this fellow sitting next to him on the plane.
Yeah, it's all, he has a number of conversations with people throughout the book, but it's all reported dialogue. So it's all sort of filtered through his own capacities for perception.
What are you, there was a moment where you said like, because this Hangman, this book has been also remarkably successful too. Mm. And it's such a lovely book. There's so many, like the phrasing and how you write. I should actually look at some of my notes here too, because we're getting near the end of our time. Yeah. And I feel like, there's so many moments, and like and there's so much humor in here, and like, mm-hmm. and things that are also like, there's pigeons, like there's a return of the pigeons, you know, there's one and then there's many by the end and they're playing these interesting roles.
Yeah.
Which now I wonder if you dream of pigeons. Mm. No, that's not fair. I shouldn't say that. But there's a moment where then the man is wondering about the pigeons, and they didn't, when he says good morning to them, towards the end of the book, he says they didn't respond. Mm-hmm. They had nothing to do with language.
Mm.
And throughout the book, it feels like there's so much about language and speaking and not being able to speak or not being able to be heard or.
Yeah, I've discovered that I'm very cynical about the capacities for language to communicate feelings. And yet, obviously, I'm a writer. I'm very attached. I'm very attached to the failed project of trying to communicate feelings and ideas in speech. And I was just doing an event with some poets who were speaking, I guess, much more positively about the potential for language and about language as this kind of not just a tool, but almost like a divine current that can be scooped up, and I was really moved by it, and felt the discrepancy between my own approach to language or my own negative estimation of the capacities of language and this sort of beautiful image that for me at least is aspirational. And I was realizing, I was like, maybe my problem is with English. Like, maybe my problem isn't with language, but maybe it's with English. And you know, English is the only language that I speak fluently, but I grew up in a home half the time, in my father's home, where English really wasn't spoken. My family spoke Amharic, and yet I didn't speak Amharic. And so I felt when I was there, sometimes kind of trapped in silence, but also feeling like there was a divine current all around me that I couldn't scoop up, you know, occasionally people would offer translations, but I could always tell that something was being lost in the act of translation. So I feel pretty like trapped in English. And obviously, again, it is the language that I use to communicate every day socially, and then also with myself when I'm doing
and creating.
Yeah. But I have a very sort of like contentious relationship to it, and I think that that influences the shape of the narration in the text and the narrator's struggle. I mean, the narrator, you know, the book is written in English, and the narrator speaks multiple languages, and there are switches between language throughout the text. In the paragraph just beyond the little excerpt that I read, there's a flight attendant who asks him if he wants coffee in presumably English, and he isn't sure what he wants, and then she switches languages and he realizes that he wants coffee. So I was really interested in how language shapes reality and also shapes desire. I feel my confinement within English pretty much every day. And so that was something that I was sort of like working through as I was describing the journey of this person who's going back to his home country after many years away.
26 years.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And I do think of him as narrating the text in a language that isn't his own, or that has become his own, but was not his native language.
When did you understand his journey more, Maya?
Well, I understood from the beginning that he was going home after a long time of being away. And I understood those sort of loose biographical details that we were talking about earlier. So I had some sort of vague sense of his past. And I knew that he believed he was going home because his brother was sick. And I knew that at a certain point he would begin to believe that his brother was dead. I knew that he was going to a funeral. I wasn't sure whose funeral it actually was. So those were things that I kind of knew from the very beginning. And then at about the halfway point of writing the first draft, I started to be able to see the shape of the end of his journey.
How did you feel that, do you think? Or is it impossible to...
Well, I remember I was at a residency, and I remember speaking with another resident who was there. She's also a novelist. Her name is Angie Cruz. She's really, really wonderful. She was extraordinarily helpful to me when I was there. And I remember talking to her. She hadn't read any of it or anything, but I remember talking with her at about the midway point when I was really trying to figure out, like, okay, whose funeral is this? And I had a few ideas for whose it could be. And we were talking a bit about it. And it was through the process of sort of describing things to her that I myself came to consciousness around what was happening. And it's often that way for me. Like I really like talking with other people, and oftentimes these things are revealed through conversation for me. Even if someone hasn't read what I'm writing, it's just like the act of describing it to another person that surfaces things that are otherwise kind of unknowable to me.
And so you do, you really value the residencies when you go to them, and you're working now on a new project. Is it the project that you've been working on since Hangman, or is it?
Yeah. And I should say about residencies, I really normally don't talk with people there about like what I'm working on, but this was like a pretty unique experience where, it was my first time working on fiction or working on a novel, and, Angie was very kind to me, but I don't normally use other people at residencies as sounding boards at all. I normally like keep it pretty.
Oh, right. Like
keep
you it said pretty earlier, private. You're like, yeah. Okay.
What I'm working on now, I haven't been working on it since I finished Hangman. I was working, I started trying to work on a different novel last year, that I still am attached to, in many ways, and I hope to return to it. But the thing I'm working on now, I started writing as a short story about a year ago, and pretty quickly discovered that it was too much for a short story. So that's what I've been working on since, and it's been a very different writing process than the writing process for Hangman.
How so?
It's just taking me some time, you know. I feel like I'm coming. It's still really a mystery to me, and I'm coming at that mystery in a lot of different ways. And because it's taking a while, I mean, it's, you know, it's been less than a year. It's not that long, but
not long at all.
But I do feel like, I don't know, I've like experienced a lot of change in the last year. So I feel like I'm coming to the text as many different versions of myself, which can be frustrating at times. I'm trying to convince myself is also valuable.
Oh, yeah. It will be. Yeah. Especially because sometimes, like, after you, with the novels, I imagine after you've written one, you've been in that world for so long, and then you have another one that you're not willing to let go of completely, mm-hmm. but for a time, mm-hmm. because this other story is becoming bigger.
Yeah.
And so you want it to be remarkably different for yourself,
yeah,
as someone going into it, finding it,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, no, and it's bound to be. I mean, I think if you're writing in a place where you're finding a way to, yeah, access some of that unconscious material, it's bound to be very different from whatever you wrote, you know, like even a month ago or a year ago or 4 years ago or whatever. So, yeah.
Well, come back anytime to talk to
Thanks.
So you're here for this week. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow you'll be in person at mm-hmm. the University of Michigan Museum of Art, mm-hmm. UMA, and you'll be reading from the new work.
Yes. Yeah. I'll be reading from the beginning draft, the beginning drafts of the beginning chapters, whatever. I didn't say that right, but you know what I mean.
What's the working title, Maya?
Right now it's called Holy Fool.
Great. That's okay. And so that'll be tomorrow. Yeah. Folks can come. And then on Friday, you'll be doing a craft lecture on secrets that are conscious and unconscious. Mm-hmm. I think
we'll see if I do justice to that,
I think that sounds wonderful. I'd like to thank Jason for being behind the glass today. Thanks to JAV. Thanks to Julie Cadman Kim at Zell Visiting Writers. Thanks to Claire at Literati Bookstore. Thanks everyone out there listening today. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation with Maya as much as I have, and thanks to Mom for listening. Until next time, I'm T. Hetzel.
When you see down and see that, and see that, and every day that
Neil and Bud, the President of the United States is in his office now and would like to say a few words to you, over.
Hello, Neil and Bud. I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House. And as you talk to us from the Sea of Tranquility, it inspires us to redouble our efforts to bring peace and tranquility to Earth. For one priceless moment in the whole history of man, all the people on this Earth are truly one.
WCDN FM Ann Arbor, keeping Richard Nixon's vision of peace and global unity alive with sounds and music from all the cultures of all the people all over the world.
That music is destructive. We had good music playing for people. It happens in society, on the streets. You know? I feel like my music have a new record coming out. I feel like, well, maybe this time they'll hear it.
Maybe we can intro with that. Lululemon.
Yeah.
Good evening. Welcome to another episode of your daily sports report. Excuse me. It's cold out. Forgive me. I'm your host, Paul, and we have pretty good duo on the panel. We got Max, we got Caleb here with us today. How are we doing, guys?
Doing well.
Pretty good.
Yeah, so today's show, this is the University of Michigan, so we are going to start off with some Michigan basketball, hopefully look to transition into a bit of NFL later on, but I want to start off with, obviously, game last night, OT, Michigan ekes out. Big time win in Detroit against Wake Forest. We had a couple of our guys at WCBN, Ethan Somers, Jaden Fode, on the call for that, along with Zach Warshaw. Hope you guys checked that out last night. Really good stuff. But Michigan, they looked really good. Elliot Cadeau, I think, aside from obviously getting dunked on, he looked pretty good. I think a lot of people overreacted, but I thought he played really well. Ade Mara, I forgot how many blocks he had on his own. He had 5 blocks. And the commentator kept on pointing out how Wake Forest was pretty much scared to drive the lane, all that stuff. So defensively, I think we looked really good. Offensively, Mara overall had a game